Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and we get underway here with Reporters Roundtable Thursday with a tidbit of news of I guess, ongoing news, we should say. It's something with we understand is a major project that the Legacy Foundation, which is Lake County's own community foundation, has set up here, and they're looking for everybody to vote. And we know that the old Chicago joke, well, maybe not quite a joke, vote often and vote several times, vote often, is definitely true in this case. At least it's legal in this case. You know, we can say that it is legal for you to vote more than once. And what we're talking about is a program which is called the Endowment Building Challenge. And we'll find out more here. We have with us from the Legacy Foundation, Carolyn Saxton. Carol, thanks for joining us today on Regionally Speaking.
Well, thank you for having me here. And this is an exciting project for Lake County and for the agencies that are involved in this project. It is an endowment building initiative that we established. We're providing $50,000 in matching dollars for those funds that are raised by five different organizations, and Lakeshore Public Media, of course, is one of those. The idea is to raise money for an endowment, and the organizations were selected through an application process, and we're going to be matching 50 cents on the dollar for every dollar that those organizations raise. You're right, we do have the voting often initiative going on today, and it actually continues until noon tomorrow. Each one of the agencies that are involved in this project, we encourage them to put out a plea on their Facebook page or Twitter, whichever social media that they or their own website, whichever social media option that they choose or options that they choose, and to encourage their donors to vote for their organization. And the highest winner, the highest number of vote getters will receive $300. The second will receive $200. And this is in addition to the match that they also will be receiving. So we encourage people to go to the Legacy website, which is legacyfdn.org. They can vote there, or they can go to each one of the organizations' websites individually and vote there. So we've got five organizations that are involved in this process. I mentioned Lakeshore Public Media being one of them. Meals on Wheels is another. Tri-Town Safety Village is the third. Rebuilding Together of South Lake County is the fourth. And Boys and Girls Club of Northwest Indiana, the Rob Gardner Fund that was established in memory of one of their board members, and actually a board member of Legacy, Rob Gardner, who lived in Crown Point.
I understand that the Legacy Foundation, this is a year-long project, we should say. It's not just something that's popped up here just very recently, but over this past few months or so that you folks with the Legacy Foundation have been working very hard to come up with a project that will benefit a number of organizations here in the region to be more self-sustaining. What was the thinking that was done by the foundation's board that kind of led to the creation of the challenge?
The project, which is the Endowment Building Challenge, was established to exactly what you're saying, to encourage our organizations to think about long-term sustainability. And one way that they can do that is by building an endowment so that they can ensure that there will be support for them, not just today, but in the years to come. And that's what an endowment does. It provides ongoing support, yearly support from the income that endowment has generated. Legacy Foundation is really committed to long-term giving and to long-term sustainability for the organizations that are serving Lake County. We have actually about 340 different funds that we manage at Legacy Foundation.
Wow.
And we just ended our year with about $62 million in assets. A number of those are for organizations that are serving people here in Lake County. You know, like these that I've just mentioned, but also a number of other organizations. Through this initiative, we decided that we wanted to focus some dollars on those organizations that were really committed to thinking about their long-term sustainability. And so we decided to take $50,000 to use as this match. It was a competitive process in determining which organizations were going to be selected. And so each one of these organizations had to put together a plan that we reviewed and then made decisions about which ones we felt could meet that challenge. So in addition to the dollars that we're providing for this match, we do have these extra little incentive programs that we're going to be doing along the year, and one of those is this one that's really focused around social media. And so I do encourage people to go to either the websites of these organizations or to the legacyfdn.org website and cast their vote, and they can cast it once a day. You can cast it. I can cast it. Your children can cast it. Your family members can cast their votes. But one a day. It closes at noon tomorrow. So vote today, and then you've got until noon tomorrow to vote again.
In going through the project, creating the project, and you've said you have all these organizations that the Legacy Foundation helps out with some kind of financial assistance. Did you realize in going through all the books, so to speak, that many of these organizations don't have some type of a way to be able to be able to build a better financial sustainability? We'll just say, for example, like Meals on Wheels, they're busy fixing meals to get to people that need them the most, but they're probably not all that busy sitting down and looking through the books and trying to figure out how are we going to keep things going for the next year or 5 years or 10 years.
Well, and it's interesting because a number of organizations do have endowments with us, and they are thinking about tomorrow. Mm-hmm. They aren't just thinking about today. It's difficult to do that sometimes when you are thinking about, you know, fixing meals that you're going to get out there or getting on the radio today, and providing support for that. But really thinking about how are we going to serve people tomorrow? And through endowment sustainability, that's the way to do that.
With these organizations that are participating in this very special challenge, and Lakeshore Public Media being one of them, when the paperwork came in, were there any things in particular that you were looking at? I guess if it were in the business world or the commercial world, we would say it would be like a business plan. Was there anything in particular that you were looking for to be able to qualify organizations to be able to be involved in the project?
We did look at the commitment of the organization to the overall project, and we looked at what it appeared to be their past capacity in raising dollars for their annual giving so that they would have a donor base that they could approach and encourage to give an even different type of gift. So, for instance, and I'm going to use some examples of the types of gifts that people might give. They may want to give gifts of stock. They may want to give, if they're on a have reached retirement age, there's a required minimum distribution that they may need to take from their IRA, and they don't want to bring that in as income to themselves, and they would like to support an organization, and this gives them the opportunity to do that. Certainly gifts of cash or any other types of gifts that the donor may be interested in giving could be counted toward this. The only thing that won't be counted are gifts of in-kind. So, for instance, if someone gave, said they're volunteering for an organization and that volunteer effort, which certainly is critical to many of these organizations, but they say that volunteer effort is worth a certain dollar amount, we can't match that. Mm-hmm. But we certainly could match donations that those individuals give to these organizations.
And we mentioned that in this particular case, we have the voting one person, of any person for that matter, per day, and the voting will end tomorrow at noon. Once the voting officially ends tomorrow at noon, what happens with the challenge from that point on?
Well, for that challenge, we will make the award of who got the most votes. And then what we will be doing is working with the organizations and meeting with them quarterly over this upcoming year. And during that year, we will be having different challenges that we'll be offering. It may not be the same social media challenge, but it may be a different one that we come up with. It might be an organization that raises a certain amount of money in a certain period of time. And so it's important for the organizations that are involved in this project to get that information out to their donors. And we will be doing it ourselves through our own social media as well.
It sounds like it's a great project, and you have some interesting ideas, I'm sure, for what the next phase is going to be after we have the social media challenge that wraps up tomorrow at noon. And you have two more quarters or more until the end of the calendar year for this. Some good ideas probably coming into the board as to what's next. What can we do next to help out?
That's right. And we're not giving those away yet.
Well, of course not. They would be giving away how things are going to be set up for
right.
the rest of the year. That's not right.
But we're excited.
It's not a surprise.
We're excited about this project, and I think the organizations are as well, because it gives them the opportunity to reach donors that perhaps might be giving at a different level than they would for an annual giving campaign, but giving at a level that will have long-term sustainability.
Mm-hmm. Is this just a twist, I suppose, to what the Legacy Foundation has been doing all these years? Because we know there have been other programs and other events that have gone on, and we've talked about this in the past in previous conversations that have gotten people involved in the community in one way or the other. There have been specific conversations over meals, to be sure. That's one of the latest ones that have come up. And other things like this have, I guess, been interesting topics to bring forth to citizens in Lake County to get them thinking, to get them talking, and in turn, especially to get some action to get them going. This is not unusual, certainly, to be sure that this is just one of the very many phases that you can take advantage of, right?
Well, you're right. And I'm glad you brought up the On the Table project. And that's a project that we've done for the past couple of years in September. And we will be doing On the Table again in actually 2 days, September 25th and 26th.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at how we might change that up a bit, and we haven't quite made the final plans for that, but we will be having also some focus groups of people who've participated in On the Table in the past, and if anyone would like to be a part of a focus group over the next month, we're going to be pulling together individuals from Lake County who've participated in that to talk about some of the issues that they've identified and really think about strategically how they might have more impact in making changes around some of those issues. So if anyone is interested in participating in one of those focus groups, please contact me at csaxton@legacyfdn.org or give us a call at 219-736-1880. Also, mark your calendar for September 25th and 26th for the next On the Table.
Oh, great. Now, Carolyn, if you'll give us a recap here, especially about the last few days, a day and a half, I suppose, that we have for this particular part of the social media, segment of the Endowment Building Challenge.
Yes. Yeah, so the Endowment Building Challenge, we're matching 50 cents for every dollar that's raised. So you give a dollar and it's worth $1.50. The Social Media Challenge, go to any one of the websites of the five organizations that are participating and vote. Cast your vote for that organization, or go to legacyfdn.org and cast your vote there. As a reminder, the five organizations are Lakeshore Public Media, Meals on Wheels, Tri-Town Safety Village, Rebuilding Together of South Lake County, and the Boys and Girls Club of Northwest Indiana, the Rob Gardner Fund.
Carolyn, thank you for stopping by and bringing us up to date on the project and the thoughts behind it, because this is such a, it seems deceptively simple. And I guess the concept itself is, but there's a lot of work, a lot of thinking and planning that has had to go behind all of that here. Months of planning, I would imagine, as we're getting this project started for the year, and we will continue on until the end of 2019. Thanks for being with us to give us an update, and we hope to have you back again to do the update, especially when we get on the table going again in this fall. We'll have to have you back on, talk about that and remind us about it together.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Carolyn Saxton is the person in charge of the Legacy Foundation, which is Lake County's own community foundation. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Let's jump right in talking with our reporters here in Northwest Indiana about the stories that they have covered and posted, not only had online in their newspapers, but in print as well, in print as well as online today. Carol Carlson with the Post Tribune with us first. Carol, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you.
Well, you have some great stories here, some stories in particular about politics and local politics. And we have now a member of Northwest Indiana's legislative delegation who is at least he's put his foot in the water, I guess, testing the water with maybe only one toe, maybe his big toe, to find out if he wants to run for governor. Tell us more about Eddie Melton.
Eddie, of course, is a Democrat. He's from Gary. And he announced, I believe it was on Tuesday, that he is forming a exploratory committee, and he is looking at challenging the incumbent Republican, Eric Holcomb. He has not made a final decision yet as far as getting into the race, but he is starting to accept campaign donations, which is a pretty strong indicator, and he is planning to move about the state and visit every corner and listen to what people's concerns are. Then he said he's going to come back and make his announcement on whether he's going to go forward.
Now we know when he made his announcement this week, he happened to choose the Gary Teachers Union to where he made the official announcement. And that wasn't just because the TCU building happened to be the only building available at the time to be able to call everybody together. There's a very serious reason to Mr. Melton why he wants to have the Teachers Union in some way involved, because as teachers, I know one of the issues he's brought up many times.
Yeah, education is definitely going to be one of the cornerstones in his campaign if he does choose to go forward. He has been in the forefront of the Gary Community Schools state takeover, brokering the bills on the with the Republicans on the other side of the aisle. And he has also been in the forefront of trying to get teachers' salary raises, but has been unsuccessful in that avenue, but he is probably going to get a lot of support from teachers.
I mentioned that he's been visiting places around the state, talked to people already, but he's going to do a formal statewide tour. What are some of the details, if we know about them yet, about what he wants to do?
He has not announced the cities he's going to visit yet. He did say he's going to start in his own backyard.
Right.
He represents not just Gary, but Hobart, Lake Station, the New Chicago area. And he's going to hold meetings in those areas first and move outward across the state from there.
Now, I know that you have talked to a number of Indiana State Republican, Democratic Party leaders about his getting involved in the race, even though he hasn't officially said so yet. What have they said about the possibility that Eddie Melton might be a candidate?
Of course, the Indiana Democratic Party folks are being neutral. They should be, because they're probably going to have at least three or four other candidates in that primary. So nobody at a statewide level, at least that I know of, is picking a candidate at this point. Frank Mervan Jr., the North Township trustee, introduced Melton, so I would infer that he is going to be a supporter,
mm-hmm.
along with at least the Gary Teachers Union, and their president is head of the statewide American Federation of Teachers, so there's probably a good chance the AFT will be in his corner as well.
Now, what have the state Democratic organization had to say about his chances should he decide to be a candidate and if he's successful beating out the rest of those that do decide to get in the fray?
They wouldn't speak specifically of Melton's chances, they do believe that Governor Holcomb is vulnerable, and that's based on polls and support for him that they think make him susceptible to losing, I guess is the best way of saying it. They said that he doesn't have a high recognition level among citizens, and his approval rating, I think, was around 50%.
Not have any of the Republican Party officials had anything to say about this and learning about this?
I have not spoken with Republican Party officials, so no. I don't know. I would presume that Holcomb won't be challenged in the Republican primary.
And he has, we know for sure, that it's been already been stated in some media as well that there's a sizable war chest, so to speak, his campaign funds. So he'll be well stated to be able to go out there and campaign for re-election later,
yeah.
I imagine.
I'm sure he'll be well situated.
Well, one of the other stories that you had also in print and online, Carol, talking recently about the Gary Community School Corporation and one school in particular, the Bailey Preparatory Academy, I guess is probably not in the best light right now, and they've had to, I guess, issue an apology because of an incident that has involved an 11-year-old boy who's a student at the school. Tell us where this young man came into all of this and why he seems to be in the news these days.
Yeah, it's a really unfortunate incident. It took place May 23rd. Many schools have these year-end gatherings and celebrations where they dole out awards. And this school had a celebration at a local restaurant, and they gave out awards, you know, most. I don't know what the extent of the awards were. Typically, they're, you know, based on academics or other areas. But in this particular case, the school gave this 11-year-old autistic boy a trophy that had a plate on it that called him the most annoying student of 2019. And it totally took the parents, you know, by surprise. They were blindsided and offended, as you might expect.
Right.
And it just led to this huge uproar that kind of resonating now I'm hearing across the country.
Now, I understand, too, that the emergency manager, Peter Marikas, had to, I guess, come forth with a formal apology, although I know he was probably doing, and other people probably within the school corporation were doing a lot of that to the family members earlier.
He has made a formal apology in to the media, as well as he has met with the family and offered his apology to them as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I am told we have filed a request for further information, but I'm told that the teacher in question has been disciplined. We don't know the extent of that discipline, whether she's still with the district, whether she's been terminated. There is a process, though, a due process that has to unfold if they go through a termination. And we also don't know the status of the principal of that school.
Now, we know that the deputy superintendent, Ms. Douglas, was very vocal about the fact that they're not happy with what happened. They certainly realize this is not something that the Gary Community School Corporation wants to have on its record, its permanent record, so to speak, because you want to treat students properly and all students properly.
Yeah, this is a district that's trying to remake its image and attract students and build up its enrollment so it can escape this emergency management system that it's under and this state control. And this is not a good way to do that, that's for sure. really gave themselves the black eye.
Well, while we're on the subject of the school corporation and in particular about the emergency management team, is there anything new that's come about? We know that the stressed unit appeals board had a recent meeting there taking care of some of the little details that Dr. Marikas has been able to bring forth to them. Is there anything that they're working on that you're aware of that will be coming up for a public view soon?
Nothing specific. Under Dr. Marikas, there have been several personnel changes, and because the structure is so unusual and it's not run like a typical school board meeting where personnel changes are voted on in public by a school board meeting,
mm-hmm.
We have no idea when these changes happen. And I kind of find out haphazardly that, oh, there's a new director here, there's a new principal here. The financial officer is no longer with the district. That's Leonard Moody, and a new person has been hired.
Mm-hmm.
And I am not sure about the status of the chief academic officer. There is a posting for a job position for that position, so I'm assuming that person is going to be gone as well.
Well, there'll be some changes, and they only have a few months here before the next school year begins, so I'm guessing they have to move along quickly, and I'm sure we'll probably, as you say, you'll probably find out later about this, and then we'll know later, too, in the Post-Tribune. Yeah, Carol, thank you very much for spending time with us to bring us up to date on the stories that you've had out there, and we look forward to having a chance to chat again soon.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
You're welcome. Carol Carlson is reporter for the Post-Tribune. This is Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and let's get the next Reporters Notebook segment underway with a bang. Not quite literally, but about as close as you can get on the radio. And we're talking, of course, about fireworks in this case, and that's why we have asked Times of Northwest Indiana business reporter Joe Pete to join us to give us an idea from a story that he had worked on and put out there in print and online about what kind of impact we could very well see, maybe soon, we don't know, the tariffs from China kind of hit home. Tell us more about the thoughts on that and what you found out.
That was an excellent introduction, Chris. Anyway, the fireworks, Northwest Indiana, as we all know, is a hub of fireworks sales. We have more than 100 establishments that sell fireworks here, many clustered along the state line. We've been, kind of a destination spot for a lot of the larger shops like Crazy Kaplan's and so forth, largely because fireworks, the aerial fireworks have been banned in Illinois, and, they're illegal, and it used to be, the state troopers would even follow cars as they left the, they crossed back into Illinois or whatever and checked their trunks and things of that nature. But and then up until recently, they were illegal in Michigan, too. Michigan did recently legalize them, but we still see a significant amount of traffic from over there, according to some shop owners, because people are so used to coming over here already, and our shops are just kind of bigger and more established with better selection. But there are concerns. Normally with the fireworks, the big issue is like, well, what day is the 4th of July falling on this year? Are we going to have good weather? Those are normally the biggest things affecting fireworks sales. But on the horizon, they're concerned because the administration is looking at imposing tariffs of up to 25% on a number of Chinese goods, including fireworks, as part of the ongoing escalation in, the trade, that's what we're calling a trade war. And the issue with that, though, is that we haven't really made fireworks in this country since the early 2000s. Fireworks factories are very dangerous. China, of course, invented fireworks, and they make roughly nearly all, well over 95% of the fireworks purchased and sold in the United States and across the world are produced in China. They just have dominated the fireworks industry since it kind of began. And then so the 25%, it won't hit this year because all the stores are already stocked up for the 4th. They're entering the busy season pretty soon. Sales typically pick up after Memorial Day, but they get really strong in the couple weeks leading up to the 4th of July. They're all good this year. But if the 25% tariffs take effect, they're worried that next year, or, it'll be felt sooner, but most people are buying fireworks. They have a couple other, they sell fireworks on for New Year's and the Indian Festival of Lights and things of that nature. But the 4th of July really is the big fireworks season. And the concern is with the 25% increase, they're not going to be able to, that's bigger than their profit margins. They're not going to be able to eat that cost. So they have to pass it on to consumers, and then it could potentially, depress sales if fireworks are prices are going up. The issue isn't like people aren't going to stop buying fireworks or stop celebrating the 4th of July. But the issue is if the fireworks are more expensive, they might end up spending less and purchasing fewer fireworks or purchasing kind of less of the higher end fireworks, and it could affect many of these shops, which is one of the largest retail segments in Northwest Indiana.
And we know that the Trump administration and the president himself has said he wants to see more things made in America. That's one of the things that he's brought up before, and some of it has come up in the discussions about the tariffs with China. But we know that that's one product that probably isn't likely to come back to America. And you talked to some people here in Northwest Indiana about that.
Yes, all the shop owners I talked to, there's pretty much a consensus. They're they think this is being done mainly with the intent of trying to reduce the trade deficit, because in some cases, like with the steel tariffs, that is explicitly to protect the American steel industry. Those directly benefit the steel industry. Those help preserve production here at a time when China is producing like 10 times as much steel as us and, you know, half the steel in the world. But with fireworks, they're very dangerous to make. The shop owners say, with as litigious as today's society is, and with all like the EPA regulations you have to follow and so forth, it's extremely unlikely that anyone's going to start any new fireworks factories. We've all seen those horrible videos on like YouTube where, you know, some of the Chinese factories will catch on fire and there'll be massive explosions, and it's just dangerous. It's just a very dangerous thing to operate. We had at one point in Aetna and Gary, there was like a dynamite factory, and there are a couple tragedies there, but that was back like over more than a century ago.
Oh yeah,
and we've generally gotten away from that type manufacturing that type of stuff in the United States.
And we know about the town in LaPorte County that was created specifically because the government wanted to set up a munitions making plant. That was back in World War One, and they had some pretty nasty times there, and had to make some very special precautions over the years too. So there are all kinds of reasons why we're not making fireworks in America any longer, to be sure. So we know it's going to be a case that they're going to be watching all of this very, very closely. And obviously the lobbying effort is certainly underway and probably started as soon as the discussion was made about this.
Yes, there are a couple of trade organizations representing the fireworks industry, which has grown to, I think it's like a $900 million industry in the United States now. It's pretty significant. It's a major seasonal employer. A lot of these places employ a lot of college students and high school students, you know, during the summer. And then some of them, in Northwest Indiana, we have a lot of year-round firework shops where they're, you know, they might be busy for the busy season, but they are, you know, open for the rest of the year. You have many that are seasonal. But the National Fireworks Association and the other trade industry there have been trying to encourage people to, appeal to the lawmakers to protest what they're calling the hashtag boom tax. They're saying, you know, this will be paid for by the consumer, by people wanting to celebrate the 4th of July and Independence Day in the traditional way and shooting off fireworks. And they've been trying to encourage everybody to kind of talk to their congressmen, talk to, you know, any elected officials and try to, you know, get some kind of exemption to the tariffs for this, because they argue that it doesn't really fit. It doesn't belong with the others because, you know, well, you know, we might even have like a garment factory or something that, you know, we're competing with China. This is not an area where what we currently or likely will ever compete with them. There aren't any American jobs in like fireworks factories, and but it is a major employer on the retail side, and they're hoping to, maintain as many of those jobs as possible by, you know, keeping the prices down and affordable.
Now, this program airs live and on stream during the noon hour, and so we go from fireworks to food, which I know you would like to cover food and restaurants and the like, and there's one restaurant in particular that you've kept a close eye on and is making some changes because of the changes in the business. It's Steak and Shake, and they've had to make some Northwest Indiana restaurant closings as a result. Tell us where you found out more about that, and in turn what you've learned, if there's anything new about the status of the Steak and Shake stores.
Oh, another excellent segue transition. Steak and Shake, they're an Indiana company. They're based out of Indianapolis. They kind of do that 1950s diner vibe where they sell steak burgers and, hand-dipped milkshakes and things of that nature. But they've recently undergone some serious financial difficulties. They've been kind of named one of the companies most likely to go bankrupt. The issue is they lost like $10 million last year on declining sales and declining in-store sales, and then they're losing. They lost a whopping $19 million in the first quarter of this year alone. They've been looking at all kinds of ways, like talking about removing the cherries to from the shakes to cut costs to save like potentially like $1 million a year. But they made a rather unorthodox move earlier this year, a couple weeks ago, where they decided they are going to try to, they temporarily, as they're saying, temporarily closed 44 company-owned stores across the country, and they are looking for franchisees to take them over to assume kind of the operating of it. And the ones in Michigan City, Portage and Benton Harbor, just in southwest Michigan, they're all closed for the foreseeable future. The company's saying it does not have any reopen date or anticipated time where they'll be reopening. It's extremely unorthodox to just temporarily close restaurants like that. The only time you normally do it is if you're doing some kind of like building renovation or something of that nature. Or occasionally you might briefly close for like a training thing. But it's just very unorthodox to just close a restaurant with no indication of when it will reopen,
yeah. And
then try to, you know, sell it off to somebody. Normally you keep it running while you're trying to sell it. And right now they're just trying to get franchisees to assume some of the financial risk. It's basically it looks like a fire sale essentially on franchises. They're offering franchises right now for like 10 grand. To run a restaurant. And for context, like if Wendy's or Taco Bell would set you back about $40,000 for the franchise fee alone, like a Pizza Hut or a Domino's would be $25,000. And that, of course, doesn't include, you know, all the costs, you know, either with building or taking over a restaurant or, you know, that type of thing. But they are, you know, desperately looking for franchisees, and they're just trying to crawl out of this financial hole that they've been in.
Yeah, I think they probably realized, and they probably should have realized this, I'm sure, years ago, that the company-owned stores are fine. You maybe have better control over everything in the restaurant, but it doesn't mean they're going to make that much more money. You're wiser to turn it over to a franchise operation, and obviously McDonald's learned that a long time ago.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Yeah, that is the way a lot of those restaurant chains become so successful, as they kind of spread the risk and, leave it up to, you know, someone who's involved in running the business directly and has kind of more of a stake in it. And that's worked for a lot of these fast food chains. Steak and Shake is technically fast food. It's kind of been described as sometimes more as like a fast akin to a fast casual, because mm-hmm. It's kind of on the more upper scale thing. A former National Endowment of the Arts chairman once described it as like, fast food hamburger served on a China plate. And, they originally did use like ground steak to make the burgers. I don't know if that's still the case.
I guess
they've been kind of struggling.
It's still pretty high quality meat, I understand, too. Maybe it's not all those high cuts that they talk about, but I'm sure they're still trying to, they have a reputation to keep up, to be sure. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. But that's been one of their problems recently, kind of finding their place in the market, because they during the Great Recession, they kind of angered a lot of their franchisees because they were trying to compete with a lot of the other fast food ones that had all those discounts. So they've been really pushing those $4 combos where they have, a $4 burger and fries, but that kind of goes against their, the perception of them as kind of being a better quality product. And then they've been trying different things like a white truffle double steak burger. So they've kind of been all over the place with their messaging, and it's, they are maybe not resonating as much with younger consumers anymore. Well, a lot of the feedback I've gotten from the story is people were saying, oh, I love Steak and Shake. It's just I haven't been in forever. Like they had fond memories of it, but it's not like, part of their daily routine or what have you.
And we know, too, that they have also, in many of the changes they have made, you notice it even now in the restaurants that are open, that you can take advantage if you have, say, DoorDash, one of the apps on your phone, that you can order food. Uber Eats, I don't know if they're set up with Uber Eats, but ones like that. And I understand, too, because I saw this from the Indianapolis media, that they have actually already converted one of their traditional stores up on the northwest side of Indianapolis from indoor dining into strictly carry out and fast food, basically by way of social media. So that may be the trend they're trying to go to not only save money, but also to get the right customers.
Oh, yes, that's a definite possibility. A lot of places will, offer both as alternatives. They have been, they're kind of known for that diner experience, but they've been probably relying more heavily on the drive-through traffic for, some time now. But, that's potentially the one complaint that's often lobbied against them, too, is that sometimes it takes a little too long for them to prepare their food.
Yeah.
So that's one thing the customers have complained. But, that could potentially have a turnaround if they were to focus on, quality, consistency. That's one. Anytime McDonald's is struggling financially, they kind of put the focus on that. They'll pare down the menu. They'll make it a more simple menu so that they can improve their speeds. And one thing that leads to a lot of customer dissatisfaction is when they get orders wrong. And if you have a smaller, more pared down menu, you know, they'll get the orders out faster, and there's less likelihood of a mistake. And then that keeps people coming back. So that might be a good strategy for them going forward. It's not entirely clear what the future of Steak and Shake is. Some people are more skeptical than others. They are also facing a $7.7 million judgment because the judge found that they, you know, owed a bunch of managers across the country for unpaid overtime. It kind of forced them to work. And between the unpaid overtime and the legal fees, that would be a steep, you know, financial burden for the company at a time when it's already facing flagging sales.
Well, I know that this is not unusual, and I've managed to talk to some of the people, too, in the years at some of the Steak and Shakes where managers would be required to work at least 50 hours a week. And not get paid, and not get paid for the hours over 40. So it's not surprising. Finally, Joe, let's talk about the story here. We go from from food now to antiques, and it's about the Old Town Square Antique Mall. We know what they're doing downtown with the building where the antique mall used to stand, but I understand that the folks that were involved in that enterprise have decided they're going to stay in business and they found another spot. Tell us about that.
Oh, absolutely. A lot of the vendors, there are about 90 vendors in the antique mall when it closed, and some of them have already like moved down the street or moved to other antique malls in Lowell or Cedar Lake. But one of the previous vendors, who also owns MJB Auction Services, Mark Gerkowski, he has secured a new building in the Crown East Business Park just off Interstate 65 by the 109th Street exit. It's in he's going to call it the Crown Antique Mall. It's about 10,000 square feet, while the old building was like 15,000 square feet. But this is like more kind of a modern like warehouse, you know, slash industrial space. So they think they're going to be able to accommodate just as many vendors, at least like 90 in there. Because the old one, it's like three different buildings. It's kind of a sprawling, rambling space with all these creaky stairwells. And it's just, you know, it was kind of hedged or kind of hammered together. And he's expecting to bring up to 90 into the new space. They already have about 45 to 50 of the vendors from the Old Town Antique Mall. They hope that, you know, the rest will eventually trickle back eventually. But they say it's a good location. It's closer to the interstate. Crown Point is a huge draw for antiquers. People come from all over, from all across the state of Indiana, from Michigan, from Illinois. You have a lot of the tour buses where it'll be, you know, senior citizen homes and so forth will take people, you know, to visit Crown Point. And then that's always been one of the bigger draws because it's the biggest one in town.
Yeah.
And this likely will remain so. And while it's not on the square, they're hoping now it'll be like the first stop for a lot of the out-of-town visitors since it is right off the highway.
What kind of particulars do we have on when this place is going to be opened up and what kind of hours they're going to keep?
They said they're going to open, they're shooting for opening in the third week of June. And then it's going to be, I think they're talking 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Sunday through Friday and 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Saturday.
Wow.
They said they're definitely going to keep it open one day later because that was one complaint that they had about the old spot, is that it closed at like 5 and it closed like too early for a lot of people. So that's one thing they're going to make sure at least one day a week it's going to be open a little bit later so people have a chance to get out there. And then they said another issue it kind of resolves from the old location was the, you know, there's often not a lot of parking around the square. Like, it's hard to find a place. You might have to circle around a couple times. And they're saying the current location has ample amount of parking, including four tour buses. And one thing they're going to take advantage of now, too, with that, is they're going to have a bunch of vintage and antique car shows there as a way to kind of draw people in. But they're going to use the parking lot and then have car shows and hopefully, you know, get those people into the store browsing for antiques.
Well, yeah, that's a perfect draw to be sure to find out if you get the antique buyers and the people that are interested the most in this, they're gonna come out there, and if they come out there with that 1956 Chevy Impala, and they're gonna show it off, and then turn, they'll go inside and they'll probably find room in that big back seat to find some stuff inside they can bring and take home. So it'll be interesting. There'll be a lot of benefits to come out of that in that particular move. And as always, Joe, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk today about the stories that you've had out there online and in print, and we'll have you back on again soon.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Joe Speed is the business reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. One of Northwest Indiana's surviving World War II veterans recalls his time served overseas on this, the 75th anniversary of the D-Day landings in France. Bill Wellman spoke with Times of Northwest Indiana reporter Allie Kirkman, and here's what Bill had to say to her.
How old were you when you joined?
Well, I was 17 and a half.
Okay.
I I quit high school, and three other fellows and I got on a Greyhound bus and drove down to Indianapolis.
What motivated you to join?
Well, in those days, a thing called patriotism was so thick you could cut it with a knife. It was, everybody wanted to go. You knew you were going to be drafted if you didn't go. And it was, patriotism was amazing. There would be whole football teams, whole basketball teams from high school that were going to service. And it was just a patriotic thing to do, because we thought we could get this over in a month and a half, you know. Mm-hmm. That's the way Americans think. Our last real, the big one was the Okinawa. And Okinawa was called the iceberg. That's what that was the key word for Okinawa, was their, they called it the iceberg. We would find a place that was good and dry, and some of them were burial grounds. They were, and they were, but it was dry, so that's where we made our headquarters. And I was got tapped on the shoulder by a captain, Captain Rock, and he said, "Sergeant Wellman." I said, "Yes." And he said, "Your papers just caught up with you. You had malaria, and you're going to be going aboard a ship tonight, and you're going home." As we pulled out of the harbor on our way home, it took 32 days to go from Okinawa to San Francisco. That's how long it took me to come home. But the first 2 days out of the harbor was our duty was burial at sea. And there were only 8 walking patients, so everybody else was banged up bad. But we had the first 2 days we buried about 14 young Marines.
So explain some of your responsibilities that you had while you were overseas.
Well, we had there were 12 of us when we were stuck together, and what we had was we had a small radar unit that we could put in bicycle carts with bicycle wheels, and we had a little tent, had a generator, and we'd go in with the first wave and we'd get to the highest point we could get before we would set up and be secured. And when we got to that point, we could pick up airplanes 80 miles around us. And the reason it was a little black tent, because it had to be dark in there so you could see the screen, just like a TV, a small screen. And it had if you'd see a blip on it, it would mean a plane. But if the blip went down, it was a friend.
Was there any point where you were scared while you guys were watching?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, every night I went to sleep, I always slept below ground. And I was good at digging foxholes, because I knew that the first time that I woke up after sleeping in a foxhole, I looked at my little pup tent over the top of me to keep it dry, and I could see the holes where flak had hit, and that's the reason I went down another foot. The deeper you got in a foxhole, the more protected you are on the sides.
So even though you weren't part of D-Day, kind of talk to me about the impact that it had. Where were you, and when did you first hear that this had happened?
Well, D-Day was what got over with. That when we first heard that Ernie Pyle was coming our way, we knew that that war was ending, because he wouldn't leave it until it was almost over with.
Can you believe that the 75th anniversary of D-Day is coming up?
Oh, it's amazing. I can't believe it's my 95th birthday mm-hmm. coming up.
What has compelled you over the years to continue to share your story of your time in service?
Oh, I think it's... it's going to be a thing of the past pretty soon. Storytellers were dying off pretty fast. And I don't know what it is now that he give you the number of World War II guys that die every day. And it just is amazing that it's going faster too.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those storytellers are going to be gone. And I think it's good to tell the younger generation that our generation did some fantastic things.
In November of 2015, the South Shore Convention and Visitors Authority and the Star Plaza Theater honored Bill Wellman and other veterans at the theater in Merrillville. And Bill Wellman's also known here in the region for the playing of taps from his front porch at his home in Valparaiso every night. He started that ritual back in 2013. And we'd like to thank the Times for putting this conversation out on the internet, and the newspaper plans to have other conversations as well with other veterans here in Northwest Indiana, for thanking them for their service and talking more about that. Reservists and veterans, by the way, are going to be noted in a new program called Stories of Honor. Northwest Indiana's Farms and Amusement Center, as some are calling it, it's under investigation these days because of an online video that shows animals being abused.
The difference between Fair Oaks Farms Dairy Adventure and the reality of the dairy industry is night and day. Everything is a lie.
The activist organization, Animal Recovery Mission, better known as ARM, released that video, of which you've heard some of the audio here. One of the group's investigators recorded footage while working undercover as an employee at the dairy farm. Fair Oaks Farms co-founder Dr. Mike McCloskey put out a statement noting that the company had fired the four employees that were shown in the video, and he wanted to work with ARM moving forward. The farm has been described as the Disneyland of agricultural tourism, drawing hundreds of thousands of visitors annually to the farm, which is just off I-65 in Newton County. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. And our thanks to our reporters being with us on Reporters Roundtable Thursday, Joe Pete of the Times of Northwest Indiana, Allie Kirkman from the Times of Northwest Indiana with her conversation with Bill Wellman, and Carol Carlson from the Post Tribune with stories from the Gary Community Schools and elsewhere, and joining us in the studio today to Carolyn Saxton with the Legacy Foundation here in Lake County. And thank you for joining us. We'll be back with you on Monday.